Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, ex-punk guitarist, Bristol blue glass blower, James Adlington, on his time in the 70s and 80s London music scene. And Bristol, of course. And James Bond is real. Mike Sparks, US Marine Corps officer. He's the first to publish a 1941 top secret memo from Ian Fleming on how to set up the OSS, the Americans' World War II intelligence service, the predecessor to the CIA. A message from Ian Fleming to Wild Bill Donovan. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, the Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you've got someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen and paper ready at the end of the show. So I'm talking to James Adlington. He's the boss of Bristol Blue Glass. No?
Yes, I am the boss, but I'm taking more of a back role.
Backseat. You've got someone else doing a managing director role or something,
yeah,
or what?
Yeah, thank God for that.
No, but you're also a musician. Tell us how that all started.
Well, when I was about 12 or 13, I got myself a guitar, a Woolworths guitar, and a Woolworths guitar amp. Not new, not brand new, by the way, but a second-hand Woolworths guitar and a second-hand amp. And
so this is early 70s?
Early 70s, yeah. And I plugged it in, turned it up to 11, and hit it with everything I got, like, you know. And I thought I was in heaven from the moment we started. So basically started a school band, like you did. And we learnt 12-bar blues, and we learnt about the blues and everything like that. And suddenly the world opened up to us on a plate, because there was a billion songs that we could cover and thing. All we had to do was learn the words and everything like that. And so we played everywhere we could.
And so where was that at the time?
That was South London. You know, so around Lewisham, the Rosalie. We played in Bromley as well, loads of times. We played the Three Tons at... you know, Three Tons.
Yes, I do. Yes. Yeah. Not there anymore. I was driving past it. And this is a long, long way away from Bristol. But yeah, it used to be on the hill on the way down. Gosh, I can't remember exactly where. Yeah. Near, not far from...
Bellingham.
Bellingham, that's it.
Yeah, Bellingham, okay. Yeah.
All gone. But anyway.
And I basically, immediately, virtually, when I started playing guitar, I started writing songs. And... making up songs, and so I then, you know, the school sort of, like, you get to sort of like 15. I stopped going to school, to be quite honest. I stopped going to school at 14, if God's honest truth.
I'd better things to do.
Yes, I had better things to do, and I could write songs. I was quite sort of like, I was a poet, and I could put songs together, and I had these things, and I was in love, and I was heartbroken, and I was in love, and I was heartbroken, and I thought the world was a terrible place. I thought the world was going to hell in a handcart, and I thought... I turned the car. I swear to God, I'm not lying here. I made the term fake news in one of my songs, way back in the early 70s.
Before Obama and Merkel.
Before Obama and Merkel and all that. It was, fake people reading fake shoes. No, fake people reading, fake people wearing fake shoes. Fake papers selling fake news.
Well done. Yeah. What was the band then?
The band was called The Splinters at the time. That one, there's loads of them, actually, to be quite honest. I sort of like was a bit of a butterfly when it came to the bands, because I was a bit of a prima donna as well. I had delusions.
Well, that helps, doesn't it? I think in that sort of situation, you've got to have a lot of self-confidence to get going. And
yeah, it's where everybody else used to be absolutely sort of happened themselves going on stage, and I was sort of let me at them.
But you definitely made this transition from covers to writing your own stuff.
I never did covers. I couldn't be bothered to do covers. Never cover a song. any band wants to do cover songs. Like, I mean, basically, if you see these bands even nowadays, and they cover numbers, and the guitarist has got a pedal board thing so you can replicate the guitar sound from every song or the thing like that. If you want to listen to it like that, go and put the bloody record on. Yeah. You can do a version of their song. You can take their song and you can do a version of it. And you can get a different sound and you can do a thing. You can even change the riff slightly and everything. But then music is progressing. Once you do a stale cover of that song, it's dead. It's not going anywhere. Nothing's being advanced. You've killed it. Stone dead. So I've had that fight time and time again.
It's difficult to imagine to put passion into singing a song that isn't actually part of your own experience as well. Was most of the stuff you were writing about things that had happened to you, and, you know, was it a way of getting it out there or not?
Yeah, a lot of it was about, I was very, very cynical about the world from a very, very young age. You know, I had songs like Black Butterflies and, which was sort of like, they feed you nightmares in a plastic cup. They tell you it's the truth, but they make every word up, you know, and it goes on, like that. So, I mean, I'm quoting lyrics from when I was 16 and I've never thought of those for years, but I was born a cynic. And I was very pleased, actually, because I went to live in France for a while, and I heard Serge Gainsbourg had a song called Papillon Noir, which was,
a French echo of your own writing.
Yes.
Do you have any success much, or, you know, sort of chart success?
Absolutely zero success. Anytime success came and sort of stared me in the face, the people around me and the people in the biz, I did know quite a lot of people in the biz, and I did play quite a lot with a lot of people in the biz. But the actual people, not the musicians in the biz, they were all victims and lovely people. But the people managing them and the people behind the thing were nothing short of satanic devils. And basically, they were using you. There was a narrow escape with Virgin Records, and up in a meeting up in Virgin Tower, you know, Euston Tower, and there, and where they were all going to be signed, and we're all going to be, you know, thing. Like, we're up there, and they're saying, I wrote a song called Josephine Wack, which was going to be a single, which was going to be a number one single. Even today, funny enough, I'm playing in a band now, which is a load of old people, like, you know, having a great thing, but they all want to play Josephine Wack because they love it. And the audience, although they've never heard this song before in their life, they all love it still to this day. I knew when I'd written it, I knew it was a single sort of thing like that. It was one of those things, like, yeah. And so we got there, and I was just saying, and I was in there, and I'm saying, right, okay, I want to talk about the single. The first thing we're going to do is release a single. And they're saying, don't worry your pretty little head about that.
That's our department, Sonny Boy.
Yes, yeah. Yes. You're just a thing, yeah. Now, go and see this girl, and she's going to get your hair cut. You're going to get your hair cut, and we're going to try you out with a load of clothes and everything like that. I said, look, I know how to dress. You know, I got here this morning. I didn't get arrested for being naked. I said, no, I dress. I'm not, you know, wearing your clothes. You know, you're the one who came after me. You're the one who came and signed us.
Yeah, but I suppose their attitude is, we've just bought you.
Yeah.
In a shop.
Yeah. Well, basically, it ended up in a fury of four-letter words. And I walked out. The rest of the band just sat there absolutely bloody silent, staring at me. You know, because I was sort of saying, I want, you know, and I've got the single, I've got a number one. Let's get this thing, let's get this dealt with, let's get a number one, then we can argue about what we look like, you know, and all this, like, yeah, you know, you, you know, and, but no, so they, I said, well, this is bull, bum, 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 and walked out, and I ran away to France that night, taking my guitars and everything with me, taking my balls with me, and everything. I came back to London about 2 years later, and this is a daft story. This is actually, but I was in a pub in Brixton, just down the road in Brixton, and I had this girl that I just met, and it was sort of like a first night out together, like sort of thing like that. And we were sitting in this pub, and there's a band playing around the corner, and I looked over across this pub, and I said, "This is going to sound completely mental." I said, but I wrote this song. And she said, you're mental. Yeah, I said, I can prove it. And she said, how's that? I said, well, let's go around and see the band, like, you know. And sure enough, it was a singer, because I'm not a singer. Trust me, I'm not a singer. I can write all the songs, I can do the melodies, I can do everything like that, but I do sing, but nobody wants to listen to me sing. Anyway, this guy's a great singer, absolutely fabulous singer. He signed for Polydor in the end as a house singer. Anyway, he sees me. I walk up there and he sees me, like, and I stand up and I like this. And last time I saw him was in Virgin. And he sees me, he gets down off the stage and lays me out completely. He flattens me. I mean, my face came up like a balloon, like, you know, he belted me properly. And went back up and felt like that. Yeah. He said, there's that bloke down there, just cost me a record contract, like, you know. And
So, what about the industry? Did you get back into it, or was that it after this falling out with Virgin?
I did get back into it with sort of like a few bands. I hung out with one of the nice things, you know, remember Eliminators, ZZ Top, that album? I heard it about 6 months before it was finished, because the guys from ZZ Top came over. And I used to hang out with all the musicians and jam with them.
But did you never regret the whole thing with Virgin? I mean, someone who was a bit wily would have gone along with their nonsense.
Yeah.
Did you never think that maybe I should have gone along with their rubbish?
No, I've got no regrets.
Until you had a bit more clout.
Yes, I know exactly what you're saying. Is what lots of people said to me at the time. You should have kept your gob shut and sucked it up. And then once you got a bit of thing...
Turn the tables on them.
Yeah, but to be quite honest, I haven't got any regrets at all. I had an absolute ball in France, and I met bands like Telephone, I met bands like Bijou, I met bands like Killdozer, and we played together, and we played in bands, and I like playing music. That's all I like. It's like, I like writing music, and I like playing music, and that's what it's all about.
And it seems like they were trying to break you at that point, really. So let's just break this guy in and get him into our stable. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And that didn't really go down too well.
Yeah, well, no, I wouldn't have lasted, to be quite honest.
What about some personalities? I mean, without doing too much name-dropping, anybody you met in the music industry you thought was really, like, you know, stood out?
Well, most of the guys, you know, the bands in the 60s, you know, the sort of like Floyd and the Stones even and all that lot. When you meet those people, most of it was met away from any sort of like function or anything like that. It was just day to day. They were so normal, just so normal Gary bloke, like, you know. But my favourite people was Steve Marriott and the Small Faces and all that lot, like, you know. And Steve Marriott, I thought he was sort of a mega talent, like, but he was sort of like such a, I mean, it was heartbreaking. He was such a sweetheart. And Ronnie Lane was, I mean, it was heartbreaking because he got very ill and he died and eventually, like, but but they were just so unaffected by it all.
What of that musical era do you think still endures now? I mean, not quite a lot of it, obviously, but is there anything you think that's like, for our time now?
Well, some
of it was quite prophetic, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I got to be honest with you. I had my son-in-law and his best buddy staying with me last night, like, you know, because they were doing a little job in Bristol. And I forced them to listen to the Isle of Wight Festival in 1969. Like, you know, I said, yeah. And these guys are, you know, they've grown up on sort of like modern music, really, like, and they said we got nothing that can compare to this today, you know. Paul Kossoff, you know, playing with Free, you know, Rory Gallagher with Taste, you know, I mean, these, you know, the level of musicianship, you know, makes me want to smash my fingers and never pick up a guitar again. Like,
but what's happened to the music industry? What's
it's the last time the music industry had any, it lost control of the, you know, what was really going on was the dance, the late 80s, early 90s dance thing. That was absolutely fantastic because it, because computers were going, and you had digital recording, and you could have looping, and you had sort of sampling, and it was the last time that happened ahead of the record companies and the management sort of like being in control of it. And you started, I mean, if you look, you got this really creative explosion of music, like, you know. Then they get their hands on it and they strangle it. And nowadays, the music industry, like, you know, all modern music is shite. You know, it is. It's rehashed, repackaged, revaluated, you know, just drivel.
It seems to me that what may have happened is that it's been turned into a sort of mass production industry in the way it's
well,
so many
after
other
that
industries
in the 50s.
Now. So the idea is that you get someone who's a lyric writer, you get someone who's, you know, whatever, you get your stable musicians, and then it's that the band is manufactured, the image is manufactured, and it's put together by them.
They were doing that in the 60s with Tamla. They were doing that with the, you know, the hit factories and all that, but they were producing quality. You know, Booker T and the MGs, you know, the house musicians, you know. I mean, they had some freedom, you know. They had some say, but nowadays it's done digitally. You know, I mean, auto-tune. And everything is on the beat. Mm-hmm. On the beat. Everything's on the beat. And, you know, and it's boring. It's boring.
What would you
it's
say to
dull.
Someone who's got a passion for music today? You know, is there any way through all this?
Just get out and play. Just play.
In front of audiences,
anybody,
in pubs, anywhere.
Anywhere. In the street, play, anywhere. The problem is that, like, you've got, like, you know, Bristol, is it Bristol in BIM or something, you know, the music thing. We didn't have schools where you could go to and learn how to be a rock star. Do you know what I mean? We just went out and did it.
It's got to come from within, really.
Yeah, because we wanted it. But if you look, I mean, it's just, I'm sorry to think, excuse me, all you middle class people out there, but you'll have to excuse me just 1 second. But if you look at all the rock stars, the Ed Sheerans and all this, they're all public schoolboys. Yeah, because they're the ones that couldn't quite become the bankers. They're the ones that couldn't become, the, you know. So push them into the music industry. You know, they used to push them into the church now, but now they push them into the music industry. So the music industry is controlled by the upper class and the middle classes. You know, if you want something that's really, really, really raw, creative, and thing, you've got to go to the working classes. You've got to go to the poor. Reggae. I mean, look at that. I mean, come on, that came out of, you know, Kingston, like, and all that, like, I mean, they're absolutely, you know, it's got to be allowed, you know, creativity has got to be allowed to flourish.
So do you get to see some good music here in Bristol yourself, and do you play some?
Yes, I get to play some, yeah, but I don't do that many gigs in Bristol at the moment. I've had something called Lyme's disease, but that's another whole story, like, okay, which has curtailed my band a little bit. We've got a gig coming up very in the near future. We've got to rehearse, people, remember that. And yeah, if you're out there listening to this, guys, you know, we've got to rehearse.
Where can we see you, James?
Well, we got a Village Hall gig coming up. I'll let you know when okay. I get any proper.
But whereabouts would you suggest if people want to go and see some decent live music in the city? What venues?
There's tons of venues in the city, aren't there? I mean, you know, I've seen some really, really good bands recently. The Thekla, I saw Samantha Fish at the Thekla, like, you know, that was quite lovely. I mean, these bands, I like American acts, to be quite honest, because I can remember back in the 70s and when the new wave came off and we were playing at the Marquee, we were sort of like doing, we were the house, I was in one band, it was the house backup, you know, support act. So when you got an act coming over from the States or anything like that, you need an act to support them just to sort of like go on. So we got to meet the Cars, we got to meet all this lot, like, and everything like that. And the one thing about American acts is they were so tight, they were so professional, you know. They weren't biz, but they were just so shit hot, in comparison to English bands, who are just a little bit sloppy by comparison, like, you know. So Samantha Fish came over. I saw the old Crow Medicine show at the Trinity last year. That was great. It tends to be, I'm an old man now, you know. It's, you don't want to, you know, you're going out watching bands and things like that. It's, you go there and it's not young kids watching old, it's old people going out watching bands. Young kids don't go and watch bands or anything like that, do they? Young kids don't even form bands nowadays, do they?
Well, I went to the old Vic to see some jazz recently. It was mostly in their 70s and 80s. I was the youngest person. Yeah.
You must have looked like a babby.
I was. Just going back to, because the golden age really was 60s and 70s. Mm. Is there anyone else you met from that era that you think, you know, you mentioned Marriott, and anyone else from that era you thought was like really genuine, someone good, you know, that you were pleased to come up against?
I was playing, this is terrible, this is. I was playing on stage with Dave Gilmour, and he was taking a lead break. And this was in the Bridge House.
So this is Pink Floyd we're talking about here. Guitarist, am I right?
Yeah, guitarist from Pink Floyd, yeah. We were playing at the Bridge House, and the guy Dick Taylor from The Pretty Things, one of the original members of the Stones, had this Perspex guitar. And it was translucent. We'd never seen anything like it. So we was like, I said, Dick, that's great. I said, what's it like? He said, well, go up, because Ian Stewart from the Stones was there as well. Like, you know, and he said, like, I'm going to drop names all day long. Seven Buds and Quiver were there. Like, Andy Wetfairweatherlow was there. Yeah, I mean, nobody's going to know who these people are. Like, but anyway,
well, some of us oldies might.
Yeah, and anyway, so Dave Gilmour was playing on stage, but I didn't know who. I didn't recognise him from anything anyway. Like, so this bloke sort of like comes up and he says, right, okay, oh, we just do a little jam. Okay, I said, like, 20-minute jam. I said, yeah, great. Like, so he's playing and I'm just doing the rhythm for him. Like, we've got a bass player, got a drummer, and we're just sort of like thing. And he's got this nice guy, he's got a nice tone, and he's going on. And the guy said, and I walked across the stage and I said, oi. I said, who the fuck do you think you are? I said, get somebody else have a go in a minute. I said, like, you know, I said, you could start doing a bit of that. I'm standing here doing it for you. Like, I said, you could just do a bit of me. And he said, oh, I'm really sorry. He said, I'm terribly sorry. Like, you know, anyway, so he stops and he let me take lead for a little bit. And we had a jam and everything like this. And everything. Anyway, we go downstairs because it was upstairs in the thing. We go downstairs to the pub and he said, oh, let me buy you a pint. I'm sorry about that. Like, so we go downstairs and buy a pint. And we're sitting outside having a drink. And I said, I've got to be honest with you, mate. That's a really nice tone, and we're having a talk. And then there's this, all these people suddenly start standing around, staring at us like... And people are getting pens and bits of paper out, like, you know. And I said, well, they ain't here for me. They're here for you. And he said, who are you then? He said, I'm Dave. I said, oh, nice to meet you, Dave. I said, you in a band? And he said, yeah, I'm in a band called Pink Floyd. You heard of us? And I said, oh.
Ah, right, okay, it's you.
But, yeah, so my claim to fame was telling Dave Gilmour to shot them.
But so where was that then? Where was that?
That was the Bridge House in Little Venice.
Okay.
Because you used to go down to the Bridge House in Little Venice every Thursday night. And basically, it was just a sort of like an upstairs jam session. And you could just turn up. It was sort of like anybody would turn up. It was fascinating. But that's where I got all to meet, because they were all old school to me. I was sort of like just a young whippersnapper then, like, you know. But my scene was the sort of like the punk scene. And so it's quite sad, really, because the Virgin thing happened sort of late summer of 76, and I got off to France, and I came back in 78. And I actually missed the 77.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but I joined a mod band after that.
So, James Adlington, it's been fascinating. Thanks very much for joining us.
That's all right.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Mike Sparks, and I'm a former U.S. Marine Corps and U.S. Army infantry NCO, non-commissioned officer, and officer. I've spent 28 years in both of those services. And during that time, I was frustrated with the equipment, almost dying one time, you know, of hypothermia. So it led me to say, hey, what's out there on the market? We call it market survey now. And I found that the British military was using a new thing called Gore-Tex in the Falklands. It was a fabric that, you know, keeps the rain out, but allows you to breathe. So you're not like in this rubber suit, you know, getting just as wet from your sweat as keeping the rain out.
Yeah, but we've now found out that this Gore-Tex contains Teflon, which is, you know, potentially carcinogenic. So, yeah, I mean, it's all very well having this stuff, but, you know, there could be some downsides as well. But, I mean, there is a problem, isn't there, in general, Mike, with military procurement, when there's a profit motive involved and potentially people from the arms industry inside the procurement process through revolving doors.
Right. They will push their item, even though they know it's flawed. Believe me, W.L. Gore wouldn't stop selling Gore-Tex if he knew that there was a cancer risk. He'd continue to push it. And because I know we got Oshkosh pushing their wheeled trucks on us, and no one in their right mind that does off-road mobility would want to go to war in a wheeled vehicle.
But there's a big downside to this, armor. An enormous downside. Yeah. That is, if you actually do have to go to war, then your equipment is not up to the job.
You're going to get creamed, and we have been creamed, but the thing that makes the difference, and it's a negative difference, is the laptop computer, desktop computer, the ability of the keyboard to lie away these tragedies is it's grotesque. It's intolerable. In other words, in World War II, we would write a written report saying, look, we were restricted to a road or trail. We got blown up. We lost 11 guys. This is intolerable. We've got to go to track vehicles. None of that's happening because the ability to lie creatively with the keyboard and the mouse is just, it's stopped all cause and effect, objective reality reform in the military.
Now, I mean, the reason we're here at this point with this Duff procurement policy in the West, and there's been attempts to wrest the British Army and British Forces procurement away from the Ministry of Defence. Actually, it's based in Bristol here at Abbey Wood. Mm-hmm. That's where the procurement's done, but there have been attempts to privatise that, amazingly, and turn that over to private interests, including US military private interests. Thankfully, it doesn't look as if that's happened yet, but this is a crazy state of affairs, and it's been brought about, I think, really through an obsession with privatisation, but also a general degrading of the integrity of people making the big decisions about what happens in the military. A lot of that has, you know, to do with the intelligence services, the misuse of intelligence. So let's just recycle back right the way to the end of the Second World War, Mike, because I know you've been looking into some characters who were involved in setting up the modern intelligence systems, like people like Bill Donovan. I mean, he was called Wild Bill Donovan at the time. He was probably not very well known by the public, but he was a very powerful person within the intelligence services in the US and liaising with the Brits, wasn't he? Can you just tell us a bit about who this guy was?
Yes, I can. He was called Wild Bill from his exploits in World War One, so he has hands-on objective reality experience with war, but he kept himself current, so he knew things like weather, how weather could be decisive in war. So he was able to get Hitler to delay invading the Soviet Union by several months by diverting his attention to the Balkans. And that may have been decisive, because by the time the Germans attacked Russia, which is a bad idea, but they were set on doing it, the winter closed in on them before they could knock Stalin out, you know, take Moscow.
So, I mean, this is the winter of 1941. Barbarossa has happened, but the Battle of Stalingrad through the winter of 1941 is really the turning point of World War II. And what you're saying is people like Donovan understood that if they could just delay that invasion of Soviet Russia by Nazi Germany, just even for a few weeks, that could make all the difference, that they wouldn't be able to take Stalingrad. So this is really, this guy obviously is a pretty major strategist in World War II, Mike.
Very clever, and he was humble enough to ask for help. So he asked, Commander, First Admiral Godfrey, Commander Ian Fleming's boss, for help, how I set up this Office of Strategic Services. So Fleming, this is what we know, was staying here in the United States with Ernest Cuneo, and he wrote a 72-page memo.
Okay, now, year are we talking about, though? Because this is quite crucial, isn't it? Because there was quite a lot of liaison going on between Roosevelt and Churchill before the U.S. officially entered the war.
Right, so it should be 1941, early 41. So we know it's obviously handwritten because, he's not going to sit there and type it, not at this point in his career. So we have to assume he would have given it to a clerk typist. There are plenty of them around. So I believe this mystery 72-page document exists in a typewritten form. But I'll take it any way possible. But the thing that's bad about it is nobody seems to have it today, which is, it's got to be a lie. How can something, an important document this important, nobody has it? The National Archives here in America don't have it. I asked them. The British Imperial War Museum doesn't have it. I asked them. Q, your garden where you guys have your records. I haven't checked, checked them out. But you have to do these things, some of these things in person, because, and I hope you don't mind me giving away some secrets, but, they're a secret, but it's not quite a secret. But in the book, The Secret War Against the Jews, John Loftus, I called him up for help, and he just says flat out, sometimes when they don't want you to find something, they will misplace it in the file. So the document, in this case would be Fleming to Donovan, 72-page reorganization for OSS. It's not going to be under that heading. They take the document, and they'll put it like how to dig latrines for covert warfare or something.
I mean, I can confirm what you're saying, because I was looking into the Battle of Arnhem, and one of the famous stories is this spy, King Kong, Christian Lindemans, who was sent by Prince Bernhard into Holland to supposedly liaise with the Dutch before these airborne landings, the 101st, the 82nd, and the 1st Airborne Division in September 1944. We've just had the 75th anniversary, the biggest airborne assault in history. And it turns out that Lindemans was actually working for the Abwehr. He went to Colonel Kiesewetter from the Abwehr in Eindhoven and immediately handed over all the details he had about the landings which were about to happen. And that file, after he'd been interrogated by the British after the battle in Britain, a very detailed interrogation of Lindemans, who confessed to everything, saying, yes, I did go and I did tell the Germans before the battle. All that documentation completely disappeared from the Supreme Headquarters Allied Forces Europe, which was in Brussels at the time. So all the documentation of that interview and the interrogation and the debriefing all disappeared. But not only that, Mike, any record that had ever been there also disappeared. So this sort of thing does happen. I think if documentation and records are important, then and particularly to history and still fascinating and would be relevant and newsworthy today, then sometimes the whole lot is just disappeared from the archives completely with no trace.
Right. We would refer to this whole thing as quote-unquote paper trail. So the question is, in a digital age, do we even have a paper trail? Digital trail to find when you can just erase it or get your sledgehammer and start destroying your laptops and desktops and burning them if necessary.
Google has an equivalent called the right to be forgotten. So if you are a powerful, wealthy person, you can get your lawyers to tell Google, right, remove this from, I mean, we're getting into Orwellian territory here, aren't we? You know, this is how you, you rewrite history, and you literally can do that now, probably more easily than you could 40, 50 years ago. But anyway, interesting to hear that Ian Fleming, the Bond author, was over. I know he was working for the Senior Service Naval Intelligence during World War II here in Britain. But what was he up to early in 1941? What was he up to over in the US?
I hate to say it, but I think he was instigating Pearl Harbor for Churchill. Basically, they knew that if the United States wouldn't enter the war, then we're finished. We have to get the United States into the war, which means you got to have a direct smoking gun attack on, you know, the American soldier, sailor, marine, airman. So they baited an ambush for the Japanese to attack by moving the fleet from San Diego to Pearl Harbor. I mean, that's like obviously stupid.
But hang on, because why would Ian Fleming be interested? Because, I mean, that's only going to get the United States involved in a Pacific war. It didn't get the United States to declare war on Germany and to get them involved in Europe, did it?
It did, though, because unfortunately the Japanese had broken their ties with the nationalist Chinese, who they were supporting in 37, and then they joined the Axis with Germany. So Hitler, this is another one of his fatal mistakes, felt compelled to declare war on the United States after, you know, Pearl Harbor, the day after.
Amazing. So, well, one way Fleming was involved in that as well. But anyway, I mean, we think of Ian Fleming as quite a good character because at least after the war, he tried to write about many of these things in fictional form and tell us in a coded fashion. But anyway, so what was he up to with Donovan? What was he planning? What was he plotting in 41?
He wanted to basically, you know, get that action to happen, but he was also wanting to get an American equivalent of, you know, Stevenson's, you know, group, you know, British Security Coordination. He wanted an American counterpart, American intelligence service that also did sabotage and subversive stuff. You know, wouldn't just be a bunch of people reading reports. He wanted to be able to, you know, take direct action, as we call it. So all that sexy James Bond commando stuff. And while he was here, he also went to Camp X in Canada, which is a good thing to do, because if you're fighting somebody, you don't want them to be, you know, sending, you know, trainees to your spy school and figuring out what you're doing. So they set Camp X up in Canada.
So what was Camp X?
Well, it's a spy school. It's the British spy, you know, every Commonwealth and Americans would go to it, and they'd learn how to do these dirty tricks, like, you know, swim with a limpet mine attached to your belly, how to, you know, subversively kill people with pens, you know, pens that have, you know, 22 caliber bullet in them. They're doing all the James Bond stuff. So really, James Bond is Camp X, because one of the guys that was running the place, Paul Dean, D-E-H-N, after the war became a Hollywood scriptwriter, a Pinewood scriptwriter, and he wrote the script for Goldfinger. And he was one of Ian Fleming's instructors at Camp X. So I hate how people try to diminish what Fleming's warning is about by trying to paint him as a bureaucrat who never did anything. When he was awarded for five medals, decorations for valor in the field.
Now, I know you've published...
He was just a desk-bound bureaucrat. How did he get them?
You've published this memo from 1941 from Ian Fleming to Bill Donovan, memorandum to Colonel Donovan, which is about basically setting up some kind of intelligence service, the OSS, I suppose. But this, I think, is after the OSS had begun. So what is he setting up here? What exactly? Because we'll publish this on our webpage at thisweek.org.uk.
Okay. The summary, you know, unfortunately, it's not the 72-pager, because the 72-pager is quoted by everybody. The ideal agent is about, you know, middle-aged man, and he's, you know, this and that, and he's blends into the crowd. Everyone is quoting that quote, and to include Ben McIntyre at the Times, and you've got Rupert Allison / Nigel West in his excellent Dictionary of Spy, you know, history in World War II, quotes it. And I've contacted Nigel West, Rupert Allison, former minister of parliament, and asked him, do you have the whole thing? And he says, no, I don't have the whole thing. So nobody has this 72-pager. But I will summarize when you read the three-pager. You can see in there in the language he's sending a signal to Donovan, we're going to need to be up and running by December. You can see that they both know that they're instigating Pearl Harbor.
Right, and it's dated June 27th, 1941.
Right, and it says, you know, we got to speed this up. You know, we've got to be up and running.
One of the interesting things he says is that you've got to be quick setting this up because there are already people that suspect you, and you need to move fast. Mm-hmm. You need to move so fast that they don't get a chance to get organized to stop you doing this.
Right. There is a period of time of what we'll call the honeymoon period when they don't know that you exist. And, you know, it's alluded to actually in the movie Quantum of Solace when they're interrogating Mr. White. M, played by Judy Dench, goes, you know, we don't even know who you are and everything. And Mr. White goes, that's right. You didn't even know we existed. There is that honeymoon period where you can get your agent network set up and in place before, which is you got to take advantage of it. You know, there was a lot of hanky-panky going on before America joined the war officially. And I think Ian Fleming was critical in keeping Spain out of the war. This is a research hunch I have. I haven't followed it up. But Fleming spent a lot of time in Portugal, which means he's spending a lot of time in Spain. My research speculation is that he met with Franco and talked him out of joining the Axis powers. And that was critical because the British, you know, have Gibraltar to control the entire Mediterranean Sea. This is stupid.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is, Spain was very sympathetic to Nazi Germany. And in a way, without officially joining the war, they provided a very powerful back channel for the Nazis. I mean, for example, laundering money for the Nazis, this sort of thing, allowing free passage to Nazi agents. So they weren't officially in the war, but actually they were definitely helping the Nazi side, weren't they?
Right. They're playing both sides. And the thing is, the British say that's the best deal we can get. They were so desperate, they even had a plan to have a team of agents live behind the walls. This is Ian Fleming's idea, one of his ideas. Live behind the stone walls inside Gibraltar and spy physically on the Germans if they couldn't keep Gibraltar. So I think that's totally hairy.
Anyway, you know, so the end result was the setting up of the OSS, which was then followed by the CIA in the 1940s. What was Donovan's role as at the beginning of the CIA? Because, I mean, he was quite well respected at the end of the by the end of the war. He was, you know, he was considered to be the master of his craft in the U.S.
Right, but he was betrayed by Alan Dulles. There was a rivalry there. Alan Dulles was a Nazi fascist. He should have been, you know, tried and executed. Alan Dulles was being spied on by FDR by way of, hey, have some free office space in the New York, Rockefeller Center. They were, you know, listening in on Dulles. They had him to write. You know, they were actually using phonographic records to record things back then. So just because you don't think they could do something, they had a low-tech way of doing things. So they had him, Alan Dulles. So what they did is Alan Dulles started a rumor that Donovan was having an affair with Truman's daughter. I mean, it's sick shit. I mean, stop. And that smeared Donovan in the eyes of Truman. So Truman shut the OSS down in 45. They said, we're not going to have an American Gestapo. And then 2 years later, what do you think Truman does? He sets up the actual American Gestapo, the CIA, populated 50% by former Nazi war criminals.
Amazing. So what, you know, what does Donovan do at this point if he has nowhere to go? Does he just retire quietly?
Yeah, there's not much he could do. You know, he had some health problems, and he ran out of power. You know, his political patrons were out of power. FDR made a fatal mistake of switching out Henry Wallace, who would have been a great president, energetic young guy, figured out how to make crops grow to feed people. He was an agricultural expert, and he was for the people. He was for democracy. And 6 months, or is it 6 weeks, not very long, before the actual nomination in 44, he's kicked out by FDR in favor of Truman, Harry S. Truman, who is in the pockets of the industrialists. He becomes president. You know, Truman becomes president when FDR, quote-unquote, dies. I think he was poisoned, incidentally. There's a guy who's written a book on that, that Truman, FDR was murdered by poison at Warm Springs, Georgia.
Now, there are, now, this is certainly an interesting topic about whether that happened or not, because, as I understand it, Roosevelt did not want to drop the atom bomb. And
correct.
At that point, he was saying, well, look, you know, if we just simply threaten to do it, the Japanese will surrender. They might not surrender, you know, quite as suddenly, like within days. It may take a week or a couple of weeks. But, I mean, these weapons are so horrendous, we don't even need to use them. Just the threat of using them will be enough. And so you're saying that you think he may have been murdered for that reason, assassinated for that reason, or other reasons?
Well, keep himself from being prosecuted. My main reason is he was dead to rights by the... If you know, FDR administration, they were going to try him as a war criminal. So the best thing to do is take out, whack FDR and replace him with, in the wings, your guy, Truman. And as far as the atomic bomb goes, this is going to stun you. Oliver Stone, in his History of America, does an excellent job showing the American generals and admirals, even the people behind the Manhattan Project, didn't want to drop it on Japan. But that it was the entry of, you know, the Soviet Union is what caused Japan to surrender. So we could have done our demonstration of the bomb. Soviet Union could have entered the war. Japan would have, you know, capitulated.
How do you mean the Soviet Union forced the end of the war? What do you mean by that?
Most people, most historians, when you go and look at it, was, you know, Russia invading Manchuria at the end of the war and, you know, declaring war on Japan is what scared the crap out of them to stop fighting. The U.S. Air Force, Douay, apologists will lie and say, "Is our bombs ended the war?" Well, they're lying. They're doing it to push their strategic bombing of civilians agenda. You know, 1947, Truman signs the National Security Act and creates a separate service Air Force, and their whole raison d'existence is we're going to strategically bomb, terrorize, bomb the civilians. Oh, by the way, we won World War II in the Pacific, which is a lie.
Back to Fleming again, because I find him a fascinating character, because you can't help but love him for the films and the books that he's given us. But he does seem like he's up to no good in the Second World War, actually, you know, doing some incredibly audacious moves. I suppose people might say, well, you know, he was creating history by what he was doing. He was playing God,
yeah,
almost.
But, you know, I have to agree with him on Pearl Harbor. How else are you going to get the American people to join the war unless we get our ass kicked? It's something Churchill struggled with. He says, do I let them bomb Coventry and let them know, or do I stop it? And then they'll know that we have the ultra secret. We decrypt their messages freely. You know, the Enigma machine. He let a British city get bombed in order to keep the secret.
What was the intelligence organization that was created by Donovan then? What agency was that?
Well, Donovan created the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, which is, you know, nicknamed Oh So Social, because he, you know, brought in a lot of these people who can infiltrate the Illuminati's. And, you know, I use the word in plural, like if you're going to blend in with people, rich people, you're going to have to be tall, white, gamble. You got to do all that stuff if you're going to blend in into a, you know, casino in Portugal and play, you know, high stakes games against German ABWAR agents. And I'll give another research thing. You know, I haven't had a chance to write, you know, sequel to the book James Bond Is Real, but I believe he also met with Admiral Canaris of the ABWAR, the German intelligence service. And I think Fleming convinced him to work for us. And then, you know, Canaris paid for his life, with his life. At the end of World War II, 44, they took him out of control of the ABWAR and put him in a concentration camp, and he died there. He was murdered. He's a hero. One of the hero, unsung heroes of World War II is Admiral Canaris, who knew fascism was wrong. Nazi fascism had to be stopped from the inside. So he had to pretend like he was, you know, loyal Hitlerite, but meanwhile he's helping us.
I suppose that was a story they didn't want to come out. Now, I noticed this memo, which I'll put a copy up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Yeah. It says, copy to Department for Naval Intelligence and also to Mr. Stevenson. So this is the Churchill-Roosevelt security liaison that was also going on at the time and had been going on from since before the war. So these people are very rarely talked about. I know that the Bill Stevenson organization is written about in the book A Man Called Intrepid, by the other William Stevenson. It's very confusing because he's actually writing about another guy called William Stevenson. But he's a terrific Canadian journalist that wrote all this. Another book is his book, The Borman Brotherhood, by the same William Stevenson. Terrific stuff. Then we've also, of course, got Paul Manning, the US journalist who wrote Martin Borman, Nazi in Exile. So there's just a few books if people want to have a look into some of the stuff that's come out since World War II about what was really going on behind the scenes. The reason I find it fascinating, Mike, is because I think what we're seeing is we're seeing a kind of recreation of the Nazi regime, but in a much different form, a kind of soft, friendly fascism with similar sorts of ultimate aims. And so we really do have to understand exactly what was going on behind the scenes in World War II. Things like you've been talking about, you know, tricking the Japanese into attacking Pearl Harbor in order to get the US involved in the war, to force the political class and the population to get involved. But what other books would you recommend which talk about this aspect of the conflict?
Oh, I definitely recommend Nigel West's Dictionary of World War II Intelligence, because he's given away a lot of stuff. I think he's one of them. I think he's very close to the CIA. But he likes Fleming, too. A lot of good Fleming stuff in the dictionary. I used it, in fact. And then, of course, Bodyguard of Lies by, what's his name? Revealing of the ultra secret.
Hang on. Isn't it somebody Cave Brown? Isn't it? What's his first name?
Yeah. Brown.
Somebody Cave Brown. Anyway, yeah, I know the one you mean. The quote, of course, comes from Winston Churchill, that the truth is so precious it must always be surrounded by a bodyguard of lies.
Yeah. I wanted to make my sequel book, James Bond is Real, Bodyguard of Spies.
I mean, because what he's saying there is that much of which is another Churchill quote, which is the truth will be kind to me, I know, because I will write it. And what Churchill is saying in that quote is really that much of what he's writing is lies, because they continued with these lies right after the war, because some of what they've been up to was so horrendous, people would not want to know about it. One of those things is Churchill and his Private Secretary Desmond Morton cooperating with Martin Bormann, Hitler's private secretary, right at the very end of the war, and in fact smuggling him out of Nazi Germany as he was the signatory to the Nazi bank accounts. But that's a whole nother story. It's just fascinating, I think, to get, you know, your take on. So what's the final word on Fleming? I know it's a difficult one, but was he the good guy? Was he the bad guy?
Absolutely a good guy. He's definitely a man of the people. He's in the Illuminati. He's doing everything he can to make the Illuminati do good things, even though they don't want to do it. And he's definitely trying to warn us. And incidentally, that was Anthony Cave Brown on Bodyguard of Lies. He also was connected after the war to MI6 SIS as a master spy, working under, you know, journalistic cover for Kelmsley Newspapers Foreign Department. And I've discovered new things since I wrote the book. Just a few weeks ago, I learned that a C-124 transport plane full of Air Force photo intelligence experts had a incendiary device go off, and the plane ditched. And the 53 people on board got into lifeboats. A plane that couldn't land, it wasn't a seaplane, talked to them, had to go back because they were running out of fuel. By the time the Coast Guard cutter Casco got there, the men were gone. And we think that the Russians snatched them, you know, gulags. for the rest of their lives.
The Russians?
Men. The Russians got them.
And what year is this? What year?
1951. And so Fleming's writing about a Russian submarine at the end of Moonraker in 53, and in the end of Goldfinger in 58, Fleming says a Boeing 377 transport plane with Goldfinger's gold ditches in the water, you know, after Oddjob gets sucked out the window. And you remember the book's different from the movie. They ditch into the water. Before he ditches, Bond calls a weather ship for help and rescue. It's clearly a shout out to the 1951 mysterious disappearance of the C-124.
Well, look, listen,
Mike. Fleming
can
only go so far.
Yeah, of course, but he's writing it as a fictional account. But look, I mean, we've just had John le Carré today criticising SIS, criticising MI6. I mean, they started on him, actually. They're saying, look, John le Carré is painting us as deceptive, as bungling, and manipulative, which we're not. You know, we're just getting on and doing our job. Well, John le Carré has come back literally on the news this week saying, look, you're talking nonsense. I'm just a fictional writer, but I'm writing the way I see it. And you guys have gone over to the dark side, effectively. I'm paraphrasing him. But this this public battle between SIS and John le Carré, that is also quite interesting, Mike.
Yes, it is. It's a laugh because I have to say MI6 is more effective than the CIA. CIA is the bungler. But, you know, the CIA says that nobody's going to care. You know, if it's out of the news cycle, you know, it's gone. Let's just say right now a CIA agent did this eavesdropping on President Trump. And we have him dead to rights. The New York Times, which is a CIA newspaper, says it's a CIA agent that did this. And no one's complaining that he had no right to be listening to the president in the first place. Nobody's even talking about that. See, that's how powerful the psychological warfare is. The American sheeple have to be, you know, led hand and foot to the truth. And if you, oh, by the way, stop talking about it, it's out of their sight, out of their mind.
So what do you think would have happened if Bill Donovan, by some fluke, had been the first CIA director after World War II? Do you think it would have gone off in a different direction?
Far better. Yes, if, you know, Henry Wallace has been president, OSS had continued. We would have had countries in Africa becoming self-sufficient in their agriculture and industries. It's too bad if they might become, you know, competitors to the first world countries. We'd have a better. We would have beat the communists that way by decency. And real democracy, not, you know, just these rich people getting to run the sweatshops. We would have had a better world, a world that we'd all been, I hate to use the P word, so I won't use it, sense comp. We all would have been sense comp about World War II decency continuing. But in 1945, the Illuminati said, look, this didn't work out right. All these enlightened amateurs like Fleming, General Gavin, Ridgway, they all had their chance to be in charge. And look what happened when they were in charge. They did fantastic for the people. They foiled our plans.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Suggest interviewees, subscribe to our email list, and listen the week before broadcast if you like at our website, dialectradio.co.uk. So, thanks to our guests, ex-punk guitarist and Bristol Blue Glass Blower, James Adlington. Also, Mike Sparks, his website, James Bond Is Real, ex-US Marine Corps officer. Also to studio engineer, Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. 0117 909 6897 or online at prsc.org.uk. If you have some of your precious time to spare, volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my 2-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.